funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is kid food so often equated with junk food in this country? And what can we learn from cultures where cooking and eating are treated with greater reverence? When Jeannie Marshall and her husband moved to Italy in 2002, they weren't yet parents themselves, but they were delighted, so delighted, by the traditions of Italian cuisine that they knew they would someday want to share that with a child. Although Marshall has since discovered that American-style food processing and marketing has begun to gain a foothold in Italy, she has worked hard to help her son develop both a basic understanding of healthy eating habits and a wide and sophisticated palate that allows him to appreciate the amazing variety of dishes available to him. Jeannie Marshall is a former features writer for the National Post and author of the new book, The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. Jeannie, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You say that people go to Italy for the food. Was that the case for you? And what exactly makes it such a draw?
Well, I when I first came to Italy, in fact, I had been in Spain and we came for a weekend. And I was so taken by how beautiful Rome is. You know, it was June as well. So the weather was nice. It was sunny and beautiful. And we just seemed everywhere we went to eat such great food. So to me, it was, I knew I'd heard that Italy had good food, but to experience was such a delight. It really was a delight. So I don't know that I actually went there looking for it, but I was so happy to find it when I did.
What's the relationship between food in Italy and history and culture there, and how does that tend to differ from the way those things intersect in North America?
Well, I think here it just seems like food is also it's also related to religion. You know, there are a lot of holidays, religious holidays, where you have to fast. And then, you know, like right now we're in the period right now of Carnevale, which is where you actually are supposed to indulge in good fatty foods coming up towards Lent, where you actually have to fast. So it has that relationship. And also, it's just that, you know, the generations, people get together over food. And, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but it's a true one right now where you see, you know, the grandmother in the kitchen cooking away over the big pots and gathering everyone together around the table. And I love it. If I ever get invited to one of those meals, I will drop everything and go because it's fantastic. But it's also, you know, it's the grandmothers doing it. The mothers, less so. The fathers, I don't think they ever did. But, well, in fact, I know some new generations of fathers who do cook like that and try to get people at the table. But that's the sort of history that it has. It's all about family and food and also religion to a great extent as well.
One thing I want to clarify, I think when Americans think about going out to eat for Italian food, they think of like only a meal that is very heavy and leaves you sort of overstuffed. But in fact, day to day, if you're eating in Italy, there is a much broader variety of foods available and people are eating things that in the balance are quite nutritious and not necessarily likely to make you gain too much weight.
No, I think that's very true. We always think of pasta, and of course pasta is a wonderful thing, but that's not all there is to Italian food. And of course the Italian food is very regional, so it differs from the north to the south. And in the south they have a lot of fish, and so there's a lot of fresh vegetables and fish, and that's traditionally what they would eat. I'm in the center of Italy, so I'm in Rome. And in fact, the thing that's part of the culture here are things like the cow's stomach and the ox's tail and the things that you might expect to throw out. And I wasn't accustomed to eating those things, but I've actually become a little bit more accustomed. I haven't cooked a cow's stomach yet, but I do order it in a restaurant once in a while, and it's quite delicious. But also vegetables, so many varieties of vegetables, wonderful things. And vegetables are an actual course in the meal, so sometimes you eat them at the beginning with the antipasto, and then sometimes you eat them with the second course, or even they are the second course instead of having meat. So I think there's great variety. Also lots of grains as well, and certainly pasta, which is wonderful, but it's not the only thing.
And long before the 100-mile diet was a big trendy thing, that was just the way things were done in Italy.
Yes, it's true. In fact, here there's a bit, you know, a sort of consciousness now about, a growing consciousness, I hope, about eating locally, and they have always eaten locally, and sometimes people were surprised to realize that sometimes food in the market was not as local as they had been accustomed to assuming it would be. And so now they call it the 0 kilometer, which means it's grown, it's not really 0 kilometers, but it means it's grown, usually the food is grown just outside of Rome. So you can count on it being far less than 100 miles. It's actually pretty close to you.
So, Jeannie, how did we get the food system we have in America and Canada today, where a lot of what's readily available to us in supermarkets has been processed and packaged in a factory somewhere before it ever reaches store shelves?
I know. And it's funny when you've grown up eating that sort of food, and then you come to a place where that's not normal, and you look at it and think, what was I doing? It's like waking up somehow. But it's true that, I guess, how did we get there? Well, of course, it's a way of, you know, for those companies of making money, because people can only make so much money from selling fresh foods, or there's only so many opportunities to sell them. So I guess the money comes in when you, it's called adding value, right? You create products, frozen pizzas, and then you start to market them and convince people that they need them. And that, you know, is an industry that has grown and grown and grown. Certainly sort of grown in my lifetime to almost take over our diets completely. And you can understand it on an economic level. It does make money. It does make sense. But on the level of nutrition, or even of just enjoying our food, it really doesn't make much sense at all.
Yeah, I think, you know, in some ways it seems sort of evil, and yet it's a brilliant strategy for selling cake mix and canned soup. But you suggest here... go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, you're right. It's not evil. It was brilliant, but it had a side effect, a huge side effect that maybe no one was really looking at, you know, at the time that it was growing, that industry was growing.
Yeah, and you suggest that what Big Food did was planted this anxiety in home cooks everywhere that they couldn't possibly make all the things their family loved without some help, when in fact some of these things are, you know, more than achievable if we just take a little time and put them together.
It's so true. I'm from Canada, and so I was in Toronto visiting family, and I happened to see a television commercial that was, I don't even know what it was, but it was what the company was, that they were selling a fish dinner of some kind that was all prepared. But the way they were advertising it was, a woman comes home from work after a long day, and she has a whole fish in her bag, and she pulls it out, and then she doesn't know what to do with it, and she brings out a blowtorch and all sorts of things to cook it. And I thought, that's so ridiculous. There's nothing easier than a fish to cook. All you do is, you know, stuff some lemon and garlic inside of it and rub it with some olive oil and salt and put it in the oven. You know, that's it. That's all you have to do, and it will be the most delicious thing you've ever had. In fact, it probably takes the same amount of time, probably less time, to cook a fresh fish than it does to cook a frozen one. So that struck me as interesting, because they're trying to play on that anxiety that we just don't have time. And the one thing that maybe they're right about is that we don't know how to do it. It's not a habit for us, because we've lost that habit.
And, of course, they will, you know, the meat counter at the supermarket or the fish market, they'll process it to the extent that if you don't want to chop the head off yourself or take care of the tail, they'll do that for you.
Exactly. They will. They will. It's funny that here in Toronto, where I was used to buying fish, it was always cut into manageable pieces, whereas here I'm always faced with having to buy whole fish. And at first I kept saying to them, what do I do with this? You know? And they thought it was crazy, and then they would tell me what to do with it, and it's not really that hard. But yes, of course, they'll certainly take the insides out, and they will cut the head and the tail off if you don't want to look your dinner in the eye before you eat it. Certainly.
So there's this thing, Jeannie, in our culture, there's the problem that many of us can acknowledge that we have with processed foods. There is also this idea of two classes of food, right? One set of items that adults are supposed to eat and will accept, and one set that children are supposed to accept. And we've almost come to assume that this is naturally the case, when in fact it's a product of marketing.
It is. It's very much a product of marketing. And foods that are marketed as children's food are very appealing to children. They often come in bright colored packages, and they are often either very sweet, very salty, or very fatty, you know, fried foods and things like that. But in Italy, traditionally, you know, it's all changing now, of course, but in Italy, traditionally, they didn't do that. They didn't separate it out. And so when I was raising my son here, I was so surprised and interested to see that people would just feed their children exactly what they were eating. You know, even if they were babies, they would just puree it. It didn't matter what it was, they would just puree it. they would try maybe not to have so much salt in it, and maybe not a lot of spice. But other than that, they didn't change it at all. It was actually quite wonderful.
And then I suppose from the time infants are really little, they develop a taste that is broad, as opposed to thinking that something that tastes like peaches should be almost liquefied before they will open their mouths and eat it. They're used to a more, I guess, a real texture in their food.
Yeah, I think it's true. Excuse me. It is a sort of gradual indoctrination in a way into the way that your family eats and the way your culture eats. So if you are eating the foods in Italy, you're eating things that taste like rosemary and garlic and you know, those kinds of flavors, you get used to that. So when by the time you're a toddler, you're already kind of used to those flavorings. It'd be the same for a child in India, where they would get used to the specific flavors of their own region and would grow up knowing how to eat them. So they have a very deep understanding and knowledge of their own foods. But that gets disrupted when instead we worry about just getting food into the baby or the child, and we give them processed and packaged foods, because they have a very, you know, processed taste to them, so they get used to eating that.
So talk about this. After you moved to Rome, you say that you sought to understand the systems at work in Italian cooking and culture. How did you set about doing that?
Well, really, it was just observation, and in some ways I couldn't help it. It was just, to me, it was really fascinating, because I could see that people didn't think the way that I did about food. They didn't have the same kind of expectations. And also, it was my husband was noticing the same things, and he would say these things to me sometimes. You know, particularly I remember one night when he said, you know, we were eating pasta and enjoying it, and he said, you know, we can't understand what a plate of pasta means to someone who's grown up with this homemade egg fettuccine, you know, with a special sauce. They, to them, it reminds them of their childhood, and it even reinforces their own sense of identity and who they are and where they belong in the world, in a way. And to us, it's just something to eat, but to them, it has all this other, you know, stuff. I don't know how to describe it. It has all of this other meaning to them. And I found that really fascinating. So when I was out in the markets, I'll never be an Italian. I'll never understand it as well as they do. But I go to the market and I ask a lot of questions, and people are very happy to talk about their food. And I've made lots of good friends, and we talk about it all the time. I have a really good friend who is a fantastic cook, and so she has been wonderful about, you know, helping me with any little question I have. And, you know, we cook together sometimes, and it's a very nice experience, and it's been a real process of learning, and I have so much more to learn. It's amazing, but it's a wonderful process, I have to say.
Well, I like the idea that the first step in learning how to cook is learning how to shop, right, to select those basic ingredients.
That's really true. And when I first came here, I had the only Italian cookbook I had was a Marcella Hazan book, I forgot what it's called. I think it's The Essentials of Italian Cooking. And that was really helpful, because at first I would go out and try to make something that I might have made in Toronto, and I couldn't find the ingredients. So instead, I was trying to go with what was available in the market, and the markets are fairly seasonal. So I would pick up what they had, and then I would come back, and I would look through this book, and I would look for things that used these ingredients. And also, I would ask people. That's also how I learned to speak Italian. I don't speak it beautifully, but functionally I do. And it was through asking people, what can I do with this food? How do you cook it? And getting 6 recipes in the process.
We're speaking this hour with author Jeannie Marshall. Her new book is called The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former features writer for the National Post, Jeannie Marshall. She is author of the new book, The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jeannie, what impressed you about the way Italian families come together at the table?
Well, I think one of the things that impresses me so much is that people really enjoy their food, that pleasure is a big part of it. So when you see people eating together, you see them enjoying it. And there's a real faith that food is healthy as well. And, when you think about it, the idea that food can be bad for it is kind of a strange one, really. We need it to live. Mm-hmm. And even a little sweet or something, a treat, it can be healthy in its way, in its context. Like eating cake after lunch on a Sunday, if that's your habit to do that once a week, it's not such a bad thing to do at all, and you get pleasure out of it, and it's a part of it. So I love that. I just love that lack of anxiety that you see and just the pure pleasure. I think that's a wonderful thing.
And it's ironic because they're not so hung up as we are on, the percentage of niacin in every bite they take or how many fat grams. But on balance, it seems like a traditional Italian diet is quite healthy and well-balanced.
Yes, I think it is. It's quite healthy. And it's so varied that I think that's part of why it is very nutritious, really. And I'm sorry to see that there is a little bit more, people are becoming a bit more hung up on nutrition. It's happening in the same way that it happened to us, in a way, with a lot of articles in the newspaper about nutrition and people starting to worry about it. And so, unfortunately, they're reaching for packages as well that have nutritional claims. You can understand how it happens. Even I sometimes will think, I'll hear something about a particular nutrient and think, did I get enough of that? Where do I get that anyway? And then I smack myself and I realize, I eat a very varied diet, so I probably don't have to worry about it. But sometimes we think of it like it's a puzzle to be solved almost, and they just think of it as a good meal. When it's functioning, they think of it as a good meal, and I think that's probably the healthier way to feed ourselves, really.
Well, it's interesting because you can pick up a box of Snack Wells cookies, which are all preservatives and artificial colors and flavors, and they'll tell you the nutritional information. But you go down to the produce aisle, and a handful of carrots or a banana, they don't have those labels on them.
Exactly, and I did some research on how vitamins work in your body, or I read a lot about how vitamins work in your body, and certainly vitamins in good healthy food work much differently in foods that have been supplemented with those vitamins, or if we take them in tablet form, or even in places where people don't have enough food to eat, in developing countries where they've tried to do supplementation programs and it doesn't really work, because ultimately, we need to eat food, and we may not know everything that's in it. We might know that carrots have vitamin A, but they have many other things that are in them as well, and things that nutritionists don't really completely know yet either. So it's not really an exact science, although we often think it is, and it isn't really a puzzle to be solved in that way. And so I think, if we just can stop ourselves from worrying about it so much, especially those of us who live in rich countries where we do really have an adequate diet, we're not undernourished, we just need to stop worrying about it and just make sure we eat a variety, shop by color. I remember my mother telling me to do that, and I think it's probably the best advice I've ever had. So you just make sure you've got lots of different colors of fruits and vegetables and a little bit of meat and some grains, and you're probably, very healthy. You'll be extremely healthy.
I want to talk a minute about snacking because, listen, I've got a house full of kids. I know that those early years can be very harried, but these days it seems when kids are hungry, they're like slurping down applesauce out of a, astronaut pouch in the back seat of the SUV. And in Italy, often even a snack is treated with a kind of respect, and you're sort of stopped and sat down at a table, and you take time to even eat, a handful of nuts or a piece of fruit or something.
Yes, and I've seen both extremes now in Italy. When my son was really small and we would be going out to the park during the day, maybe when he was two and a half, 3 years old, and I was always looking, because I came from that culture, I would think, what do I give him for a snack? And I would be looking in the supermarket aisles, and I didn't know what to buy. And then I would look at the Italian mothers, and they were giving their children cooked chickpeas because they could pick them up mm-hmm. and eat them quite easily. Or they would have little cherry tomatoes that have been cut in half, or fruit, or bananas, things like that as well. Bread is a big part of the culture. And they have this wonderful thing called pizza bianca, which every child absolutely loves. It's fantastic. Just basically, it's just sort of crispy pizza dough with olive oil on it. It's wonderful. But they also, they wouldn't eat on the go. They didn't eat in their strollers the way that we would do it. They would actually, you know, spread out a blanket, sit down, take 15 minutes, and eat their snack. And I thought, well, that's probably better than what I'm trying to do, which is, you know, hand my son something in the stroller so that he'll be quiet, so mm-hmm. that I can get from point A to point B. And I realized, okay, that's probably a better way, certainly a better way to do it. It seems that it's once they get to be school age, where there are a lot of packaged snacks that are actually marketed to children. They're called the merendine, the little snacks. And so they're cakes, ultimately, and they're quite handy to throw in a backpack. And unfortunately, they have this great snacking culture when they're really small, and then by the time they get to school, it starts to get ruined by a marketing industry that's giving them basically little cakes with white flour and sugar in them and not much else.
So what do you do about that as a parent? I have to say, your son, Nico, comes across as really an amazing eater and someone who is like open to trying new things and, you know, sort of the dream child that people would love to be able to say they had. But there is always there's peer pressure, right? Even my kids have said, we're the only ones who don't get to take Doritos every day to school. And so how do you sort of answer those questions when they come up? Or how do you answer a friend who comes over and says, what do you have to eat in this house? And it, you don't have any of the processed snacks they've come to expect.
Yeah, no, that happens definitely. When we make friends with kids who have just come from the United States or Canada, there's often a big cultural shock for those poor children. But I wish Nico was a dream child. We still, you know, he's up and down. As he gets older, he's a little bit more interested in trying new things. He's very good. If his friends eat something, he will eat it too. Mm. So he developed a love for anchovies because he had friends who ate anchovies all the time. He absolutely loves them. He eats octopus. He eats all sorts of things that I like now as an adult, but I'm not sure that I would have eaten them as a child. And that's really good. But sometimes when we encounter foods from other cultures, he's not used to the taste, and so he's a little bit more resistant to trying those. He's starting to think it's interesting intellectually, but, you know, to actually eat it is another matter. But yeah, sometimes when kids come over, if they're from North America, and you know, I make pretty simple snacks. Usually I just give him some cut-up vegetables. Tonight, in fact, when I was making dinner, I just cut up some celery and carrots, and he likes to dip it in a little bit of olive oil because his friends do that. Mm-hmm. So he did that, and then he ate a few almonds, and that was it. That was fine. I don't usually actually make anything, you know, bake anything or cook anything. It's usually just sort of things like that. But he's used to it, and for the most part, his friends eat like that as well. So that helps to support what I do. It's not just me, because if we were the only ones, we would be the strange freaks on the block, and that would make it harder for sure. It's hard to be the only one doing something like that, so at least I'm grateful for that sort of cultural support. And he goes to a school where they actually really try to support the food culture here, so I have that as well. And I'm grateful for that. So if you can create that, that helps even more.
And the teachers actually eat lunch with the students.
Yes. And even in, you know, there are schools where kids are eating lots of junk, but the one thing that's really good is the lunch. Even in the public schools, it's eroded over the years. People tell me, oh, it's not as good as it used to be, and I look at it and I think, it's still pretty good. You know, they have fresh fruit and vegetables, but they eat a very Italian meal. So they have a first course of either soup, risotto, or pasta, and then they have a second course that could be meat, fish, cheese, eggs, and vegetables on the side. And then at the school he goes to now, they finish off with some fresh fruit, and they only drink water. And they all sit together, and they have to talk while they're eating. They sit at a small table in groups, and the teacher sits with her class, and she eats the food. And when I told my son's teacher that this isn't normal in, you know, where I come from, people, mm-hmm. the teachers would never eat with the children. And she was so surprised because she thought, well, it's part of their education, was the way she saw it. It's part of for education to teach them not just what to eat, but how to eat it as well, to be civilized, you know, to use their napkin and, you know, to have to pass the olive oil or the Parmesan cheese or something like that. And I thought, how interesting that she sees it as not just the parent's role, but as her role as well, to create civilized creatures out of these little monsters that we hand her.
You know, there are a number of schools in the U.S. now, or at least I can speak to Texas where we are, where students in public schools are eating their lunches and they are, literally are forbidden from talking so that they can get their meal down within 15 minutes to kind of get done. And there may be other reasons behind this that are not clear to me, but it does strike me as sort of an appalling squandering of what could be an educational opportunity.
It does seem like that. I did observe a lunch in Toronto where the kids had 20 minutes to eat and everyone had brought their own food, and it was complete chaos. And I didn't really see much eating going on. There was a lot of, you know, grabbing of this and that and running around and screaming and yelling. It was really chaotic. And I thought, oh, no, that, you know, this is the last thing you really want to do to children. You really do want to create a bit more of a tranquil environment, even for the teachers. It doesn't seem pleasant, or the monitors who have to watch that. The whole thing just seems like there's got to be a better way to do it. But I think part of it is not giving them enough time as well. 15 or 20 minutes isn't really enough time to eat. I asked at my son's school. She said they have 45 minutes to eat lunch, but usually they're finished in about half an hour, and then they go outside to play. Mm-hmm. That seems reasonable. Surely we can do that.
How do Italians approach nutrition for pregnant women?
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Nutrition?
Nutrition for pregnant women.
Ah, okay. Yes, that was a revelation to me as well. They certainly, there were a few things that I was told to avoid, but these were things that could cause, I've forgotten the name of the little bug that gets in the salad, but it's something that lives in the dirt. And so they told me that I shouldn't eat salad because I could get sick from it, something that could affect the fetus, unless I'd washed it very well myself. But otherwise, I was to eat, you know, a really varied diet. There really weren't any foods I was supposed to avoid, but the doctor actually told me to have a small glass of wine every, you know, maybe two or three times a week, he suggested, because it's very relaxing and it helps you digest, and they don't seem to have the same fear that it will hurt the fetus. I mean, he's assuming that I'm not going to have a big glass of wine, mm-hmm. or that I'm not going to do it every day. And I suppose because it is part of the culture to have a small glass, that he can make that assumption. But I know my North American counterparts were quite shocked by that news.
Well, it's interesting because it's almost like the approach here is to assume that if they say a small glass, that you're going to, you know, fill like a juice, like, you know, a water tumbler with 12 ounces of wine or something.
Yes, exactly. Well, they mean about an inch, you know, in a mm-hmm. little glass.
And did you, I mean, did you find even, you mentioned the fact that baby food is, if not unheard of there, it is certainly the exception rather than the rule. Was it easy to adjust to that when maybe you were raised surrounded by people who bought commercial baby food in a jar?
Yes, and I also expected that baby food would be, you know, something that, you know, if you can go and buy it, it certainly it makes your life a little bit easier. But I quickly found that making the food the way that they do it, making a little brodo or a little broth, and keeping that in the fridge or in the freezer, and then just using it to thin out whatever else I was cooking for dinner. So whatever I made for dinner, I would put a portion of it in the blender and whiz it up and just add a little liquid to make it the right texture for Nico when he was really small, and then I could give it to him with a bit of olive oil and Parmesan in it, and he liked it. You know, it was delicious, and for the most part, it was really easy to do that. And if we were going anywhere, I just tried to make a little extra and put it in a little container so that I could take it to the park or take it wherever it was that we were going the next day. I tried using a little bit of the baby food that was here, you know, just out of pure laziness a few times. And mostly they were just single, you know, it was just beef or just vegetables, just carrots or just zucchini or something like that. And it didn't taste horrible, but it didn't taste very good. So every time I did it, I thought, well, you know, I'll wash it out and keep the jar because that's really useful.
Right.
But the contents were less useful. And really, if it becomes a habit, it's not that hard to do it. And also, I had just one child. I think if I had twins, I don't know how I would have managed. But, you know, just having one child, just making a little bit of extra food and making sure it's the right texture, it was only a few steps. It wasn't really anything. And in fact, it was often easier than having to go, oh, no, I don't have any baby food now. I have to go to the store and go and buy it. So really, I think overall, once you get around the idea of doing it yourself, it's quite an easy thing to do.
We should point out, too, and it's cheaper than buying commercial baby food.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
It's less expensive to make your own baby food than it is to buy something that is specifically made for babies.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's so much less expensive because it's just, you know, exactly what you are going to eat anyway. So, yeah, it only costs a few extra pennies, really.
And do Italians sort of introduce foods in a prescribed order? That's been the trend here in this country for some time as people are concerned about food allergies and making sure you know how your child responds to each new food that you introduce.
No, they don't do that. And in fact, when they saw me doing it, they thought I was out of my mind. But what people here do is just exactly, they make a broth that's a vegetable-based broth, and first, the first food the baby has is that broth, and it tastes quite good, but it's got maybe six vegetables in it. And then they use that broth to thin out the other foods that they're cooking for dinner and to give to the child. So it's always mixed. It's always got all of these nice flavors in it. That, you know, it's like real food. Whereas when I would give him just, you know, I'd put the broccoli in the food processor and then give it to Nico and he'd clam up and they kept saying, what are you doing? You're teaching him not to like food. You have to give him something that tastes good. And so I tried it after a little while and I thought, oh, am I really going to actually make a broth for the baby, which the baby will just spit out later? But I did it and he didn't spit it out. And when I tasted it, I realized why he didn't spit it out. It's actually quite flavorful. And it's interesting that the pediatrician, when your child gets close to 6 months, actually gives you the recipe so that you know how to make the broth. Mm. It's a very standard thing.
Jeannie,
and I thought it was very interesting, but I just tucked it in the back of my my cookbooks and pulled it out later when I realized how useful it actually was.
Jeannie Marshall is my guest. Her new book is called The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a former features writer for the National Post. Author Jeannie Marshall has just written a book called The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Mark in Dallas who wants to know about the sentiment in Italy regarding GMO foods that Monsanto, is trying to sell in European markets.
Mm. Well, I do hear people talk about it, and so far in the European Union, they've not let GMO foods in, and I think that's mainly because it's very, a popular opinion is to not allow GMO foods in. So I think people are quite strong about that. They really don't want it. And so far, the European Union has mostly listened to them. There was an issue about allowing GMO cattle feed and things like that, and that's been a bit of an uproar. But no, they're very anti-GMO foods. They're mostly very, anti, sort of interfering with their food in general. So that's a very strong, there's certainly a very strong lobby there.
Are fad diets less common in Italy and other parts of Europe than they are here in North America?
They're certainly less common, although they're not unheard of, for sure. If you go into a pharmacy in Italy, you find all of these strange diet bars. They just seem to proliferate on the shelves. So I don't really know anyone who uses them, but clearly somebody uses them because they are there. They're a little bit less prevalent. When I go back to Toronto, I find it's really hard to eat with people because everyone is on some sort of restricted diet. There are those who don't eat gluten, and then there are some who don't eat, you know, meat, or some who don't eat something else, you know, no lactose or whatever. And that is certainly rarer here. I don't find that here so much. So I start to think of that as another form of picky eating in a way, when, you know, everyone's got these ways that they're trying to organize their diet. And I understand why they're doing it, but it seems strange when I come, when I've been living in a place that actually sit, where people sit together and they share plates of things, and I realize I can't do that with my friends who are restricting their diets.
We have an email here from Joel, who says, I have a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old. During infancy, they would eat whatever vegetable I gave them. Now, at their current age, unless it has the word cheese in it or it is peanut butter and jelly, I cannot get them to eat anything else. I've tried hiding vegetables in their food by blending it in. They know almost instantly. Do you have any suggestions?
Gosh, that is a hard one. That's the eternal question for parents, isn't it? How do you get them to eat their vegetables? The main, you know, this is probably not that helpful, but the best way is if they see other children eating them. Certainly if they see their parents eating them and other adults eating them, it has some effect, but there's nothing like seeing other children eat vegetables. That's why I think good, strong school lunch programs are really good, when the kids have to sit together and share a meal, because inevitably there are kids who do eat their vegetables, and those who don't get to see them do it. And that has such a huge effect. And, you know, that for my son was the biggest thing. You know, there are certain vegetables that he did eat, many that he wouldn't. But now he eats almost everything. And it's partly because he sits at school. They serve one vegetable. You know, three of them pick up their forks readily, four tentatively, and then the rest of them just start eating it. It's miraculous, really. So it's, you know, it's maybe not super practical in the short term, but in the long term, if you can arrange that, I think it's a great thing to do.
Mm. How do you, and at your son's school, you had the experience of, you know, occasionally parents are called on to provide the class its snack. Can you talk a little bit about the way that works?
Yes, in fact, at the school my son goes to right now, we decided, along with the teacher, to create a communal snack. So rather than each kid bringing in their own snack for the morning, we would just do one snack. And so we take up a collection. So we have the treasury, and we pass it around among each family. So each family has a 2-week period where they are responsible. And so you don't have to make something fresh every day, because one thing that Italians do is they like to have bread with olive oil and fruit, and so those are sort of standard things that they have in the class, plus nuts we give to them. And then there were other things up to our discretion that we could bring in. So one family brought in, one day I saw they brought a big frittata in that they had cut into squares, and the kids ate that. And when it was our turn, Nico and I had so much fun going out to the markets in the afternoon and buying things for the next day. So we would buy some prosciutto di San Daniele, and then we would go and buy some special cheeses and olives, and we took those in, and the children loved that. They would all give me their report on which cheese they thought was better. And so we just tried to keep it fairly traditional. I did one day, I made a whole wheat banana bread with very little sugar in it, because the teacher doesn't want them to have sweet things, because she can see how they react when they eat a lot of sugar. Mm-hmm. And so I made that, and Nico told me there were two boys who just thought that was too weird and they weren't going to touch it, but the rest of them thought it was pretty good. I think it was because they said banana bread, which just didn't sound right. And I kept afterwards yelling, it's cake, it's cake. You know?
Try it. Trust me, you will like
it. Yeah, but I really like this. I like this communal idea. We did it for 2 weeks, and that's it. We're done. You know, we don't have to do it again until grade 4 now. Mm.
Well, you know, it is nice to think about you shopping with him. And it does seem that including young children in the process of acquiring food makes them more interesting to at least take a nibble of whatever you bring home.
It's very true. But the shopping with food with children can also be a minefield as well. In fact, we had to stop in the supermarket this afternoon on our way home from school to pick up some milk. And I just kept, you know, I was trying to rush him through, because he sees all these dazzling yogurt products and the potato chips and the chocolates and everything, and he's, you know, stopping and saying, "Oh, you know, could we maybe institute a treat day?" You know. that when we go to the market, when we go to the fresh food market, it's just all fruits and vegetables. There's cheese. There's all of those more traditional things. And so he gets more excited about those things. So you realize you have to pick your place. Certainly, yeah. Maybe taking your kids to the farmer's market is a great idea. To the supermarket is less so.
Are there, as you begin to see more processed foods creeping into at least the supermarkets, is there sort of a pushback yet from parents? Because on the one hand, I mean, I think most people would agree these things are not necessarily as wholesome for children as whole foods would be. On the other hand, they're convenient and people are busy and you have two career families. So how are people sort of figuring out how to make this work for themselves?
Well, I think that I got in trouble this week because I did write something that talked about how Italian children are eating a lot of junk food. And lots of Italians were saying, hey, what are you saying, you foreign woman? You know? But it's very true. And they do. The Italian children, unfortunately, they are eating a lot more junk food. It seems like more and more all the time. And they are eating a lot of foods that sort of masquerade as healthy foods, the things with the nutrition labels on them. And I think to a certain extent, parents are a little bit, I don't want to say naive, but they're not so used to having it in their culture, so they're not quite as on their guard as we have become. You know, they're a little bit more trusting. And so, in fact, I think it's time, you know, it's really a good time for Italians to start talking about it a little bit more. And certainly there are many parents who are aware. I don't mean to generalize because, in fact, the school that we go to right now is very aware of this problem, and they try to, you know, create these situations where we can have the communal snack, where they have the common lunch in order to avoid having processed foods in the school. And that helps because then the kids don't see their peers eating it either, so they don't ask for it as much. I was infuriated to see a McDonald's ad at a bus stop right outside of the school, but a lot of parents actually complained about it, and it disappeared shortly afterwards.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what about eating out, Jeannie? When my children were much smaller and there was a children's menu, I was distressed that the parents might have options like, you know, fresh vegetables and whole grains and quality fish and meats. And for children, there were like chicken fingers and French fries and maybe macaroni and cheese to add some variety.
It's so true, isn't it? Yeah, we don't see children's menus so much here. They are starting to appear, and unfortunately, they're the same kinds of things. You know, mm-hmm. You'd think they would have a children's menu based on Italian food, but they don't. It's often little hamburgers or hot dogs or chicken fingers and things like that. But they're still pretty uncommon. So most often you go to a restaurant, and if it's a very small child, they'll just eat from your plate. Or quite often they're willing to give you a half portion of whatever, of pasta or a small bowl of soup or something like that if it's a small child. For Nico now, he just orders off the regular menu. And mostly he orders quite well. You know, he's interested in trying a few new things. And then the vegetables usually come as side dishes, so you order a plate of broccoli and then you share it. So he'll always take a little bit and, you know, share it with everyone else. So that, I love that. I think that's great. He doesn't see the need to eat differently from the adults, and he's quite happy with the food that we all eat.
Earlier in the hour, you gave us this wonderful image of, you know, families coming together to have a meal, and maybe grandma's in the kitchen and other people are helping out. How do Italians approach introducing their children to cooking skills?
To cooking? I guess, you know, that's a good question, but I think because they see people cooking quite often, it's natural, and often children are just curious and they come into the kitchen. We a couple of weeks ago, we cooked with some friends. We made tortellini in brodo, and it was a two-family affair. It was really fun, but we had to make these little tortellini. So it's a pasta that had a meat stuffing, but you had to wrap the pasta in a certain way. So our friend Marco was going to show us how to do it. So we had to get the kids involved because we had to make 200 of these things for dinner. So we got all the kids working away on these things, and we were finished in about 15 minutes, really. And they loved it. They just loved doing it. So it seems that they're quite often just sort of called in, you know, to do something here. You know, you can chop, you can use the knife, and you can stir the pot. Or with pasta, they love making pasta, so that's definitely a way to bring them into the kitchen.
I understand.
But someone has to be cooking to do it, and, you know, in some families there's less cooking going on, and so those kids are not getting the same, you know, experience. You know, it varies from family to family, but you know, where it's happening, where someone is cooking, the kids are definitely watching and learning.
Mm-hmm. And I guess your idea is that really teaching our kids to cook is not so different from our obligation to teach them good personal hygiene or exercise habits. It's all part of preparing them to live healthfully when they're on their own.
I think it's very true. I think it's a life skill, really. And it used to be seen that way, and it should be seen that way again, I think. You know, with Nico, as he does take an interest and he does help me with a bit of cooking sometimes, and I keep telling him, you will be so popular when you go to university because you'll know how to cook, and you know, people will want to come and eat with you because it will taste good, and you know, you'll know how to nurture other people. And he likes that image. Mm-hmm. But I also like the thought that he will know how to cook. He'll know how to feed himself, and you know, he's used to eating vegetables, so without even giving it much thought, I'm sure he will buy them when he grows up as well.
I've heard reports that pasta making is no longer something that takes place in every Italian kitchen. There are people who
I think
just
that's
buy
very
it.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's labor intensive for sure. And but the one thing, it's fun. I've done it now a few times. I'm not very good at it, I have to admit, but I need to practice more. But it does take a lot of time and effort. And I've been in people's houses where they have these tables, and the table has a big indent, a big groove in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from years and years of kneading out the pasta dough, of someone probably every day making pasta. And you know, if you do it every day, you get pretty good at it, and you can do it a lot more quickly. But I was amazed that you would see these tables with this big indent in the center, and that's just from kneading out the dough. But people from my generation are probably not doing it as much. And the one thing that is good, though, is there are places where you can buy fresh pasta, and it's very simply made. They do cut it out in a machine, roll it out in a machine, and some people think, oh, you know, that's just the most awful thing. You can't do that. But it's just flour and eggs or flour and water. It's still very simple. They're not putting any additives into it. They're just little mom-and-pop operations, you know, on a street corner. So thank heavens those exist.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here. When you do go home to Toronto to visit friends and family, is there anything that you can't get in Italy that you sort of secretly crave and make sure that you eat while you're there?
Oh, yes. Well, one thing is cheddar cheese. I love good old Canadian cheddar cheese.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. So usually I'll try some from a different, a different cheesemaker each time we go, and it's so delicious. And the other thing are Montreal bagels with smoked salmon and cream cheese. Nico and I both, we start talking about it for 2 weeks before we are actually going to Canada, and then we eat them for breakfast every single morning.
Mm. Jeannie Marshall is a former features writer for the National Post and author of the new book, The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. Jeannie, thank you so much for making time for us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It was a wonderful conversation with you. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.